Welcome to episode 55 of the High Tech Forum podcast. Today, we're lucky to have with us George Ford and Larry Spiewak of the Phoenix Center. Larry and George are both veterans of the FCC, where George is an economist, Larry's an attorney. And George has also worked at a couple of private sector firms you may have heard of, MCI and Zetel, where he was chief economist. So they're extremely knowledgeable in the field of wireless, of broadband competition, and both from the legal and the economic point of view. And so the main dish in today's discussion is going to be a report that was recently issued by the Open Technology Institute at the New America Foundation. The latest in a series of analyses they've done called the Cost of Connectivity Report. And what these reports purport to do is to compare broadband pricing and quality in American cities with foreign cities in Europe and Asia, and to analyze also the relationship of commercial broadband to government-provided broadband networks. And through the year, how long have they been doing this, George? They've been doing these things for like almost 10 years.
Yeah, about 10 years.
Yeah, and everyone has been, pretty widely criticized. And there was sort of a gap. I think they've reduced the frequency of it. I don't know whether that's in response to the criticism or just simply the fact that there was a time when international broadband comparisons were like a really big deal in broadband policy, and they're not so much anymore because I think we're just a bit more sophisticated and we understand there's so many different factors that go into determining prices. They're hard to measure. There's the quality factor and all that. So we're kind of more concerned about trying to figure out what it is exactly that we need and how we can go about getting it. But the one thing I do like about the OTI cost of connectivity reports is they give George an opportunity to share some economic analysis with us. And so it's kind of like, every policy action causes a reaction. And I think George's analysis, his responses to OTI are really a lot more informative, as I think you'll see as the conversation progresses. So, George and Larry, I'm really, really happy you guys could join me. I've known you all for a long time, and this is the first time we've done a podcast. So, welcome.
Thanks for having us.
Thanks for the invite.
Yeah, I really love your background there, George. It's like, but be careful when you move your arm too fast; it disappears.
I know. I'm in the holiday.
Might freak us out. So. In your analysis, you published it in a Phoenix Center perspective that's titled OTI's Cost of Connectivity 2020 Report, a Critical Review. You raise five questions, you say there's five questions you want to answer. The first is an economic doctrine, essentially the law of one price, and how the law of one price tells us basically what the answer is going to be to any analysis of the kind that that OTI is purporting to do here when it's done correctly. Can you explain to our audience, some of whom are not trained in economics, what is the law of one price and how does it apply to this analysis?
Within a single market where there are buyer and sellers in a single geographic product market, the prices for the same service or the same product will tend to equality. If one seller has a lower price, and all the consumers will go to that guy, and the other guy's profits will decline, so they'll lower price to match. So as this process goes on, there will be one price for the product in the market. Some people view that as collusion, but that's the competitive outcome as a single price.
Mm-hmm.
There can be complications with, convenience. Some gallon of milk may cost more at the drugstore than it does at the grocery store. But that doesn't really disrupt the general concept that prices tend to be equal in the same mm-hmm. in the same situation. So what most of these studies do that look at municipal broadband pricing is they compare the prices within a market. They compare the municipal provider in Chattanooga to the private providers in Chattanooga. And that's not a relevant question. Those prices are going to be the same quality adjusted because all the providers are trying to get customers. And if your price is not attractive to customers, then you're going to shed them, lose market share, lose profits, and go out of business. So that's really not the right question to ask. So the whole basis of the study in nearly all respects is just misguided and atheoretical or aeconomic. What we do normally in these situations is we compare the prices in, say, a competitive to a monopoly market, like we used to do in cable television all the time. I wrote my dissertation in that. So what we want to do, if you wanted to know what the effect of a municipal broadband provider is to compare markets with a municipal provider to markets without one and look at average prices across the two.
Well, wouldn't you kind of have to do that in a time series way? Because, I mean, I think one of the effects of when you have a municipal provider, one of the tools they have going for them that they try to use, I think, to evade the one price doctrine or the law of one price. I mean, to be simple, they can cross subsidize. And so there is a floor. I mean, when the cost of delivering the service is greater than the retail, than, you know, the price that the provider can sell it for, I mean, it puts a commercial provider in a bind, right? I mean, they can either, you know, lose money on every transaction and hope to make it up in volume, or as they say, or they can just like say, no, I can't lower the price any more than this without losing money, and I'm not going to. But if your competitor can cross subsidize the service with revenue from some other source, like the electric bills, they can keep on lowering the price and basically drive you out of business, right?
Yeah, I mean, that's a problem with, I mean, even if you found that municipal markets had lower prices than markets without them, I'm not sure exactly what that means. All of the systems in one way or another cross subsidize. In explicit cases, sometimes there are charges on property taxes, you know, of $5 a month or $10 a month. And I know in Opelika, Alabama, I did a deep dive in their financials, and they had raised the power bill about $5 a month per customer. So, you know, you've got these other sources of income that the law of one price is going to operate on what consumers perceive to be the price of the product they're buying.
Right.
So you've got all this other stuff going on in the cross subsidy world that they don't necessarily associate with the price of broadband, even though it is the price of broadband. And in fact, what's most troubling, I think, about a lot of these systems is if you put a charge on a property tax bill, everybody pays that,
right,
not just broadband subscribers.
Right.
If you raise the price of electricity, everybody pays that, rich and poor, and that's not perceived to be a part of it, but everybody's paying it. So what you end up with is sort of this government-enforced cross-subsidy amongst consumers in the area, where the poor are subsidizing the rich in a lot of cases. You know, the poor may not even have broadband, but they're paying $5 more in Opelika for their electricity.
How generous of them.
Other people, you know, it's, and it's not unlike the Ammon, Idaho case, which was a big error in the OTI study, where, you know, there's I commit to a 20-year lien, basically.
$20. You got to pay the hookup fee, which is like several thousand dollars.
So what if I want to change subscribers, change providers?
Right.
I'm still stuck with $20, right?
So, right.
So every private carrier in that market is subject to a $20 penalty to any home, either the person who lives in it or the person who bought it from, who's made this commitment to this network. I mean, we complain about, or some people complain about lock-in, and the OTI report does that, exit fees and contracts and all that. I mean, the Ammon Idaho system's got a 20-year contract.
Yeah, right.
That's the longest one I've ever seen.
Well, and if you're analyzing prices based on advertisements, ads, the OTI data, they admit it only comes from ads, right? So they're looking at the advertised prices in the local newspapers. The cross subsidies they're not contained within those ads. I mean, they're missing all the behind the scenes economic magic that works to make municipal broadband appear to be a better deal than it really is.
I mean, all the system, the data generating price for the data generating process for the price is rigged to show lower prices.
Mm.
Municipal markets, and I'm surprised pretty regularly that when you compare them, you don't see that. Yeah. You should see that.
I mean, it just tells you something about the quality of the analysis, right, or the data.
It could, but even if you do it right, I think you find. But I mean, it's not kind of hard to do right with this data set. But
yeah, right.
But in any case that I've studied, municipal markets versus other markets, you tend to find that the prices are equal or the municipal pricing markets are a little bit higher.
I mean, you found that they're actually a little bit higher.
They are. I mean, with this data,
I mean, this is crap data, but still.
Well, I mean, it has some problems.
Number of
issues, not only in the, just in the messing up the Ammon, Idaho market. But you also, they didn't really look at the, they didn't find comparable cities to look at.
Yeah, right.
And so the cities are not really the same.
It's really an odd assortment of cities, like Lafayette, Louisiana, Chattanooga, obviously chosen because they have municipal options. But then what? I mean, they have like Paris. I mean, comparing Lafayette, Louisiana to Paris, I mean, excuse
yeah,
me.
Yeah, yeah. And what you'd want to do, and like what we did in our my big paper on the labor market effects of the Chattanooga system, is what we call in modern statistics, a matching algorithm,
mm-hmm.
where you try to find comparables that match up in population size and demographics,
right.
growth and things like that, where you actually can say, these are cities a lot like the city that's received this treatment.
Mm-hmm.
Municipal broadband. I mean, that's a properly designed survey of this nature would look at Chattanooga and go find cities like Chattanooga.
I've tried
to do that. It's not easy to do. I mean, Chattanooga has some very unique demographic characteristics. So it's kind of hard to match up on. But
mm-hmm.
there's just no effort. It's sort of let's pick some cities that everybody knows the names of or mm-hmm. whatever's convenient and. I mean, it's almost like a convenient sample.
I think it's sort of written for people that are within a bubble. I mean, there is kind of a municipal broadband advocacy bubble in the United States. There's a bunch of people that have decided that's just a cause that they really want to support. And they have little conferences and they talk to each other and they pretty much regard everyone outside the bubble with suspicion. I mean, they don't really like commercial broadband providers of any sort, any stripe.
Yeah,
and they're just they've just sort of taken that on as a cause, and once you commit to a policy perspective, then it's real easy to obtain ongoing reinforcement for the idea that your policy position is the one and only righteous position. But right. I found it really kind of telling that there's like one paragraph sort of buried in the OTI study about two-thirds of the way through, where they say that when we correct for population density and also for broadband quality, what we find is the price on it, on a sort of quality adjusted, population density adjusted basis, broadband in the United States versus, this is commercial, versus mm-hmm. broadband in Europe is virtually the same.
Yeah.
I mean, there was one comparison where there was one penny per month difference in price and another one where it was like less than 5 cents.
Well, that's why we, in economics and econometrics, we look we try to account for as many factors as we can.
Mm-hmm.
And oftentimes it doesn't take but one or two to make a price difference go mm-hmm. away. I think when you do international comparisons, that's a very complex problem.
Yeah, right.
For a lot of reasons. The cost of living is different, the wages, the income.
The way they collect taxes, the government support for prevailing infrastructure,
when you compare like mobile prices in other countries to the U.S., a lot of countries have calling party pays.
Mm-hmm.
So there's this other revenue stream that comes in.
Mm-hmm.
And most of the people that do the comparisons don't look at that. But you got to.
Oh yeah, I mean that's the entire magic for free.fr is that calling party pay system. They receive subsidies from the larger carriers.
Right.
Yeah. So I mean, obviously, it should be they're at the end of a long kind of welfare subsidy food chain.
And look, everybody's got their biases, and when I do my work, which is why we do the work we do, which is based in theory and sound econometric practice, is that we're just trying to find what's there and what the economics tells us and what the data tells us without trying to promote one story or another.
Well, I mean, we have to know what, you have to know what the facts are.
Yeah. I mean, you try to, but people with, when you have, the biggest pandemic in public policy is confirmation bias,
mm-hmm.
not COVID. And you're just looking around for data.
Yeah, right.
And you get a chance, like I demonstrated with in a recent paper on broadband surveys. When you get to design the survey, you can get whatever result you want.
Well, and especially if you can take the inconvenient answers and just sort of omit them from the data you publish, right?
I mean, that's a pretty powerful position to be in, behind the way the data is collected.
So we really kind of, in many respects in broadband policy, the line between advocacy and straight policy analysis is not as bright as we'd like it to be. But in any event, the law of one price, I think that admission that actually when you correct for all the other factors, it's the same price. In Europe as it is in the U.S., I think that's that kind of confirms that if we take the law of one price as a hypothesis and...
Well, then you're comparing cross markets, so there's no there's really no expectation of that. But I would suspect if you accounted for enough factors that we wouldn't see big differences.
It's just not rational that... And the only scenario in which I'd expect to see big differences are where you have single provider in a market.
Yeah.
And I think single provider cases are really where municipal broadband shines. I mean, if you have a rural market that has no provider, then when you get, when the electric co-op or, whatever sort of organization, political unit is active in that space, they come up with a broadband system so now people have a service option, whereas before they didn't really have one. I mean, other than satellite, which is kind of not a completely satisfactory substitute for wireline broadband. So it's great there.
We subsidize rural market broadband generally in this country.
Yeah, right.
And various programs. So I don't have a problem with governments doing it when they're going to be the sole provider. That's not really an issue for me. I think they should still contemplate what the costs and benefits of it are. That doesn't bother me. The subsidy issue, which is endemic, is a big problem when you're competing with private investment, and you come in and you overbuild that private investment and raise taxes to pay for losing.
I think that that's a problematic scenario, and it's something, I mean, in Chattanooga, they've done that, and they've claimed all these benefits, which are really hard to find. I mean, for people who don't know about this, Chattanooga forever, I mean, they're served by Comcast and AT&T, they had two broadband carriers, and now, for a long time, there was sort of a service imbalance, but AT&T is now upgrading a lot of their wireline footprint to fiber. Mm-hmm. And so they're able to actually offer symmetrical gigabit type service to their customers. We got a couple of cities in Colorado that have done this too, that had, two providers. the municipality decided they wanted to get into it. They came in with a third offering, and it's, you know, it's nice. I mean, I guess in some way it sort of temporarily starts a price war. And in Longmont, there's a price war between CenturyLink is now deploying fiber to the home, and the Comcast and the municipal system. But I mean, is any of this really sustainable? I mean, in the long run, it's just going to be, you know, I doubt that it really will have anything to do with making Longmont become an economic powerhouse. But and it really appears that the reason they did it was they're kind of a suburb of Boulder, and that sort of they have an inferiority complex about not being as cool as Boulder is. And Boulder decided about 10 years ago they wanted to have a municipal fiber network, but they realized before they could do that they had to take over the electric utility. So they've been trying to take over, XL provides the electric service. They're trying to take that over and you know, make it to where they generate power, like carbon-free power from, I guess, excess marijuana shavings or something and hippie love beads. But that is, that's the, as a precursor step to getting in the broadband business, they're kind of stalled there.
Yeah.
So, well, they did that. They're too rival. Yeah.
To subsidize, so, you know, you got to have the profits from someplace.
Yeah, right.
Monopoly and a great source of cross subsidy.
Mm-hmm. So, yeah, okay. The second thing, which I guess we kind of already talked about, is the data.
Yeah.
You know, the data is not really a representative sample. It's not, neither randomized nor representative. It's just sort of deliberately cherry-picked because, you know, I think there were certain cities in the U.S. that have high-profile municipal broadband systems, and they wanted to see favorable comparisons between them and, you know, some other cities. And they believe they found them, but your analysis indicates that, in fact, you know, what they found was that when you correctly analyze the price data they collected, it's actually just a little bit more expensive to have a municipal option in a competitive market than not. Which makes sense, right? Because of the fact that you've got now got three infrastructures you have to pay for. So the total overhead costs in the market are greater than they would be if you only had two providers.
Well, it's hard for me to say, you know, I'm not writing a paper and promoting what I found as the truth about pricing in municipal broadband markets, because I don't think you can do that with this sample. It's okay if you want to look at Chattanooga and Lafayette and wherever else, Longmont. But what you've got to do is you've got to find comparable cities when you do it. Mm-hmm. These cities in the sample aren't comparable. So I'm not really, you know, comparing apples and oranges so much when I use that data to make that difference. I suspect that if I did, if we did have comparable cities, we wouldn't find anything at all. It's just that this particular sample finds that. But the sample, I mean, I wouldn't write a paper with this sample because it's the municipal markets are not a well match to the non-municipal markets. There's some differences in education and income and size and those sorts of things that could materially affect prices. And while you can control for them somewhat with regression analysis, if the underlying incomes are just really different, the regression can't account for that. Mm-hmm. So you need a better sample for doing that. And then, you know, there are a lot of other issues with this stuff that are very hard to deal with. You've got with in many of these markets, the cable operators offer video service and they sell a lot of product in bundles.
Oh yeah.
And when you've got one firm selling a multi-product, another firm selling a single product, the price vector of the multi-product firm may look a little squirrely to you if you don't take account of the multi-product nature.
Well, and most of the cable providers do bundle, and most of the people who buy broadband from a cable provider do buy one of the bundles.
Yeah, and so that makes pricing very, very tricky because they may actually feel like, from a competitive perspective, they're better off making standalone broadband slightly less attractive bundle to drive people to the bundle. And so that's a very complex pricing decision that has to be made. So when you grab one price out of a multi-product firm, You know, God knows what you're going to get. I mean, oftentimes it just doesn't make a lot of sense standalone. But when you look at the vector of pricing, it makes
sense. Well, and that's what we've seen with pricing in Longmont for sure, is that the cable company hasn't seen fit to match the promotional price for the standalone gigabit service that the other two providers offer. And I think because they don't have to, because most of their customers buy the bundle. And the bundle is where they win on the bundle, because neither CenturyLink nor the city really has the ability to offer an adequate linear TV service. I mean, they just don't.
And
we know there's cord cutting, but still about 80% of the peak of that, of the linear TV market is still there.
Yeah.
So we've actually talked about your third question, which is the average price difference between municipal and broadband providers, and in which no difference was found, right?
Yeah. I mean, that was, this is the comparison that has, you know, some foundation in economic theory and in empirical economics, where you, it's the scientific method. You give some cities a municipal broadband treatment, a pill, so to speak, and you give the others a placebo or nothing, and then you compare to see if there's an effect. That's the question, the proper hypothesis. And when you do that, in the limited sense that I can do it with that data, you do find that prices are about 10-15% higher in the municipal markets in this sample. Mm-hmm. Now, a bigger model and better data may offer a different solution to that. That's what this data says. I don't suspect that was their intent, to gather a sample that would say that, but it's kind of the problem when you set out to gather a sample and do a study, when the people really don't have any experience or training,
right,
and those kind of things, you know, you kind of stumble and make those mistakes. And that's what's happened here. And it's happened in almost all the others. I mean, people start doing statistics that don't know statistics, you can get some.
Well, that's a good thing about Sabermetrics and Moneyball, is that it's really helped to spread knowledge of statistics across a broader population.
Well, you see it works. I mean, it isn't voodoo, you know, it's statisticians get a bad rap sometimes. But when you see statistics being used to put together, baseball teams that look odd, you know, from just the general perspective, and nobody would ever think to put that together, but the data tells you to do that, and it works. And, Dale Kahneman's book, I think he Fast and Slow, he all the research shows that just a little bit of data can make for much better decisions than even expert opinion, just a little bit. But you have to have somebody who knows how to collect the data, or if they don't, if you got a bad sample, how to fix that, or at least acknowledge what.
Well, and how to combine the tangible and intangible, subjective evaluations of future potential. I mean, it's hard, even if you had perfect data, because you can't predict what's going to happen to people as they grow, how much stronger they're going to get, are they going to get injured? There's all these other factors. But when you make these obvious errors like small sample size and ignoring relevant variables, then, you're obviously going to get, you can tell this has been kind of like a doctored analysis.
Or when you just exclude on purpose, a huge portion of the price of a service.
Yeah.
Because it's not being charged by some retailer, but being charged by the city. And they do that. It's not that the authors of the report didn't know that there was a $16.50 charge from the city and a $20.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, everybody knows that, because this Ammon model is widely discussed in the muni broadband circles, and people brought it up on my local city council when we were talking about allowing the city to have limited participation in broadband markets last December. Somebody, one of the witnesses was asked by a councilman if he knew what the Ammon model was.
Yeah. Well, footnote 95 actually says, you know, what the charges are. They just we exclude them. Why?
Well, we didn't get the right answer when we had those.
When I looked at just the first few pages of it, and you saw these prices, and you're like, there's something. You know, I mean, it's immediately. It's you say there's something wrong with this. This doesn't.
Yeah.
And then you start looking at it, and you go, oh, okay, now I see why.
Yeah, you see what they did. Well, Larry, you've been very patient. I mean, I think you've been meditating, right? You got your mantra going, and you're ready to jump in, because I got a question that I think is gonna require your expertise. Like,
sure.
The thing that concerns me personally about municipal broadband participation in competitive markets is that the municipality, it puts the municipality in a dual role. So on the one hand, they're a provider of services, and on the other hand, they're a regulator of the services, you know, they provide. And so if they want to, you know, they can use the regulator role to impair the ability of commercial firms and of competitors to enter that market. Is the, and I think we're starting to see that actually throughout the U.S. In the fact that municipal codes have to be updated to allow for small cells to be constructed, small cells being small radio cells of low power that can be used for principally for 5G, but also can be used for 4G wireless, and actually could be used by a Wi-Fi based ISP if they wanted to. And so this provides the possibility of having new entrants in the municipal, in the market for broadband services, as well as, you know, better quality mobile phone, not as many dropped calls and that sort of thing. How problematic is this from a legal standpoint?
Well, I mean, it is problematic, but that's not to say that people haven't attempted to remedy it. I mean, you know, first off, many states, have laws on the books that have tried to prevent this type of improper cross-subsidization. And I think, as we've discovered, I think Burlington, Vermont's a classic example. I mean, you know, legislator said, okay, you can do this. You got to, you know, oversight by the PUC. And what do they find? That, you know, the muni broadband system was just raiding the coffers of the city treasury. I mean, so it's not like we have try here to do that, which raises one branch of the tree, so to speak, of municipal broadband providers have been trying very hard, being unsuccessful at the state level, because the municipality is a creature of the state, to try and, as they're unsuccessful for removing these laws at the state level in the state house, is to try to go to the federal level to try to get these laws overturned. And we've had that.
That's something that the Wheeler FCC tried to do, right? They tried to get into,
Back before that, one of the last things that came up under Bill Kennard's tenure was a case in Missouri. And it was a municipal broadband case. And the FCC was asked, it was under, because they provide a telecommunication service, Section 253 gives the FCC express preemption power under that statute. And they had argued that we are an entity for purposes of the statutory definition. And the general counsel at the time, who was very, very talented, Chris Wright, looked at it and said, you know, look, I think there's a constitutional problem between the federal government intervening in the relationship between a state and municipal subdivision. So actually, the Kennard FCC's credit, they said, as much as we love to do it, I think Bill Kennard in his concurring statement says, I'm reluctantly voting for this. Mm-hmm. But going to the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court held in a case called Nixon versus Missouri Municipal Leagues, said the federal government cannot intervene into the relationship between the state and a municipal subdivision. And that kind of ended the debate for a while, but the community broadband advocates are very important. So when the Wheeler Commission came around, given the net neutrality decisions in Verizon v. FCC, then in U.S. Telecom, where Section 706 which, by the way, has not the word preemption in it at all. Wheeler viewed that as a way to say, I can exercise preemption. And his argument was, and he recognized he had a Nixon problem. He said, well, you know, I realize I can't intervene in the relationship between the state and this municipal subdivision. So once you provide service, my argument is that now you're providing service, it's now an interstate service, federal law trumps state law under 706, where again, there's not the word preemption in it at all, I'm gonna preempt. That went to the Sixth Circuit, and the Sixth Circuit, a very, very narrow decision. I mean, it was one of the smallest opinions I've ever read, just said, well, there's not a clear statement by Congress and we're gonna do it. So that kind of died. But that's not, I mean, that's not coming back. The Democrats in their, in the giant $3 trillion House bill passed a very expansive preemption provision in there. But again, I don't think that survives Supreme Court muster, which then goes to your point though, which brings up a second issue of, let's say that even they are allowed to get in and states have no control over the municipal subdivisions. Your question specifically is there something sort of anti-competitive or violation of due process? And the answer of that is yes. There was a case about 20 years ago, I think it dealt with municipal electric power. It was called City of Lafayette, went to the Supreme Court. And if I recall the case, and I'm sorry, I haven't looked at it in a while, but—
Is this Lafayette, Louisiana?
Yeah, I believe so.
Uh-huh, okay.
And all this, by the way, will be detailed. George and I have a 90-page law review on everything you want to know about municipal broadband coming out in the Federal Communications Law Journal, probably in the next couple of weeks. So we really detail it.
So you guys heard it here first.
Exactly. And by the way, all of our work on municipal broadband is available on our webpage at www.phoenix-senate.org. And we actually have a, on the right, you'll see a topics page, say municipal broadband will be more than you ever want to read. And all of George's papers there and my papers there. So anyways.
Well, I hope you guys will come back and let us do a thing about your new 90-page paper. It's gonna.
Oh, we will. Thank you. I appreciate that.
Take me a while to get through it, but I'm looking forward to that.
Yeah, the students. It's the students have been working on it for months, and you know, I give them a lot of credit with COVID. I mean, it's just a mammoth paper. Anyway, so the Supreme Court said, look, you can't say that you have some sort of sovereign immunity from antitrust because you are clearly not doing this, quote, to protect the public weal or to promote the public weal. You are clearly competing.
The public welfare, yeah.
Exactly. You are clearly trying to compete against the private sector here. So if you're competing against, now nobody has brought in any trust case since, but, you know, I think there is one right. If you can show, as George, I think, proves in his work that, you know, there's some sort of predation with, you know, you violated the cross-subsidization protections and you are clearly pricing below price. Below cost. Now you also have a due process issue. And there was a case that came out of the DC Circuit a couple years back. It was actually dealt with Amtrak. And when I read it, I immediately thought of municipal broadband. Because what that case said, Congress had passed a law that allowed Amtrak essentially to be both regulator and competitor. And the Association of American Railroads sued and said that violates due process. And in fact, DC Circuit agreed, you cannot be both regulator and competitor. I think that that is a phenomenal precedent. Nobody has tried to cite that and make that argument in suing against municipal broadband, probably because they're trying to deal with the legislative issue. These avenues, you know, depending on whether it's in, you know, stage five of the COVID bill or the Democrats take all control and, you know, that very expansive preemption is included and it actually gets upheld, you still have these avenues. But, you know, there's nothing wrong, as George said, with that. It's the question of, you know, for any trust laws, have you harmed competition? And in the case of the due process, are you regulating against me and competing? And in the Democrat bill, you know, it's actually, there's a line there I don't have in front of me, but they say, and you can continue to regulate, you know, people under your jurisdiction. I'm like, wait a minute, you know, this is, it just smacks of a due process violation. So that's very much out there. Whether or not people want to pursue it or not, that's another issue. You got to get standing, so forth and so on. But, you know,
what would it take to get standing to challenge that?
Well, in other words, no, No, you would have to, then there'd be a case about that. But no, if I was a large broadband service provider,
mm-hmm.
And it obviously be fact specific, but if I was a broadband service provider in Chattanooga, whatever,
pick, mm-hmm.
and again, without looking how much, you could hypothetically make that argument and say that you are violating my due process. Nobody has made that yet because the politics of municipal broadband, you know, unfortunately, you still have to, it's the old line, you can't fight City Hall.
Mm-hmm.
And it's been this very tenuous thing. I mean, don't forget there was a thing in New York a couple of years ago where Philadelphia, they wanted to build a wireless network. And the politics of this are very volatile is the best way to do this.
I think
the problem with municipal broadband, speaking on, you know, putting on, take off my lawyer's hat, putting on my, you know, political analyst hat is that, you know, the goal is, George, I think, summed it up the best. Why do we have municipal broadband? Because the private sector won't go there. And that's, you know, one situation, if you're out in Function Junction, terrific.
Yeah, but there's no competitor there to oppress with your right. with your conflicting roles as regulator.
The equilibrium is less than one, exactly. But, yeah. But there are people that believe that the government should actually compete with the private sector.
Uh-huh.
The problem is, and we did this paper a couple of years ago, you know, as, you know, broadband becomes increasingly commoditized, which means you can't price differentiate, you know, having mm-hmm. How many networks do you need? One.
Yeah, and right.
You know where this yeah. goes. So having this notion.
Well, and some people just believe this should be a government job.
Right.
It's a utility. Everybody needs it. It's all the same. So, you know, just let the government provide it. And then we've got some way to control prices. And we have a very efficient system because we don't have redundant networks. Of course, that kind of falls apart the first time you have bad weather and you lose, you know, one of your networks goes down. It's kind of good to have that back, that other network. But anyway, some people just believe that. It's just a kind of an article of faith.
Exactly. And you have these, you know, rather clever, I think, gradations over this after a while, because, mm-hmm. you know, at some point, you know, I think the financial industry is realizing that I'm not going to issue municipal bonds to finance this because I have to at least have some sort of, I mean, you know, the reason why municipal bonds are generally good is they're backed by the full faith and credit by the government.
Right.
Particularly in these worlds, it's like, why am I going to spend something that I know you're going to lose money? I mean, it's one
right,
thing
right.
why, you know, the Chattanooga system had a mm-hmm. large amount of their money came from the BTOP money from the Recovery Act.
Right.
Where it's all Americans paid for a piece of this.
Uh-huh. If you got that kind of deal going, then why not build it? I mean, it's basically like found money.
Well, and now you have sort of a different kind of model, which is, I think cities are going, you know, running a network's really hard.
Yeah.
Don't forget, you got to advertise, you got to have customer mm-hmm. service. So
provide customer service, which is the main thing that, you know, today's providers get dinged on.
Exactly. So what they're doing is saying, well, you know, a lot of people are like, well, I'll tell you what, I'll build the dark fiber network and then you sell.
You do all the hard stuff, yeah.
And, you know, Utopia was built on that and mm-hmm. you know, people lost their shirts on that. And the tax are stuck with the dollar, you know, with these huge funds. So these are all very, very problematic.
The city of Fort Collins, Colorado, just built a municipal broadband network, and timing couldn't have been worse because, bam, COVID strikes, and they're looking at bankruptcy. I mean, the city, their costs are so high, and their revenues have just basically a lot of them disappeared. And thanks, you know, I guess they probably wish they had that money back, but too late now.
They had in Opelika, they'd sold their system for 20 cents on the dollar or something like that to a private provider mm-hmm. after years of claiming it was profitable.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it was probably 4 months after that deal, they had a problem with their water system. The running water in houses was coming out brown. They had some kind of algae, and the city said, we don't have any money to fix it.
Well, I know Wilson, North Carolina, they were laying off cops and teachers.
And that's where this, I mean, they say the money's just not cross subsidized, but they you look at the books and that money's coming out of the, you know, you know, the electric systems in these muni places provide a steady stream of profits to municipalities, and then they take all those profits and they dump them into the broadband network. Well, those profits used to go to the general fund, and now they're going to the broadband network. So yeah, it's going to affect the police and the teachers and the road maintenance and all those things too. It's a mess.
Well, it'd be kind of nice if the electric utility was investing those, their profits in making cleaner power, you know, providing greater resilience. I mean, doing, you know, doing speedy repairs when they have a weather-related outage. I mean, there's a lot of, you know, it's not like electric utilities are just generating, you know, all that just free cash for anything and everything. I mean, it's got to be kind of
And what you have to, you know, recognize is that, you know, years ago, because I know because I wrote the first rulemaking after the 96 Act letting utilities into telecom, because I used to be an energy attorney before I became a telecom attorney.
We've always thought of you as a high energy guy.
There you go, Perkin. You know, and everybody thought, oh, these electric utilities are going to, well, the electric utilities are all subject to regulation by state PUCs, right? You got to have prudence, you know, things, you know, it's got to go into cost, you got to do rate base. Munis are not, have that. They're essentially self-regulated. So there is no oversight to go, hey, you know, what are you putting, what are you shoveling into rate base so that your captive rate payers have to pay this?
Yeah.
And, but you know, but the bigger problem is, I think, you know, George and I have talked about this a lot, and you can see Chattanooga is a great example of this, is that they don't sell these muni systems as a necessity, but they sell it as a sort of an economic development story. And start selling this as economic development. Oh my God, it's going to be fantastic. And millions of people are going to want to move to my little hamlet. It'll be great. And as George says, well, if you build the first network, then somebody else is going to build the network. And then why do I have to move? Because this isn't business migration. It's business stealing. And we've made
In
some of our papers. I mean, it's just, people all get worked up about this. And it's like building a giant sports stadium. I mean, it's almost the same thing. What are we doing here? And, you know, part of the problem is, like I said, in a lot of these small cities, you know, it's the old 80-20 rule. You know, 20% of your customers give you 80% of your revenue. So if you're in a somewhat of a small town, you know, what are your biggest customers? City and maybe the local university. And if you've got those locked up, you're going to have a really tough time having a business case for any network. You know, because residents always, you know, it's nice, but it's not, you know, that's not where your big profits are generated. It's your business customers and, you know, selling enterprise services to those, you know, big, you know, use the phrase anchor tenants.
Yeah. people don't seem to appreciate the fact that every policy action seems to provoke a much more massive reaction. So one, you know, one city builds a broadband network, then like a half dozen cities around them that are losing jobs, they've got to do their own thing. And now you've got, massively overbuilt infrastructure and below price competition going on and people moving back and forth, and, probably the service quality is not any good anywhere. So like, what do you do?
Well, and the other problem is, and this is something that we've been dealing with for forever, is that what George and I describe as unrealistic expectations of market structure. I mean, what we've learned is that you're not going to get five wireline networks. George said when we were both staffers at the FCC many, many moons ago, you would have told me back when we were at the commission in, you know, 94 that we'd have two wireline networks. We'd throw it a party. But, you know, and so, you know,
And you look at what's going on with the, you know, with the telcos that were a bit slow to get into fiber to the home.
Right.
They're both in it, you know, in it big time with both feet right now. And that's a, so we actually have, we've created a market. I mean, it doesn't have a lot of players, but it's a market where competitors are free to compete on the technical quality of their service.
Right.
I mean, so where you have this kind of artificial competition like they have in Europe, where everybody uses the same infrastructure and you differentiate your services from your competitor on price and you know, how snazzy your ads are, or some other, you know, they're less tangible factors at work. The problem of getting upgrades into that common infrastructure is very difficult. I mean, it's they've come up with different solutions in different parts of Europe, and you know, they each are sort of partial solutions. But it's, you know, when you have a direct competition between the cable company and the phone company on measurable things like download speed, upload speed, you know, uptime, doesn't that put the incentives exactly where you want them to be for the constant improvement of the quality of the broadband network? I mean, which is what we strive for.
You do. And that actually was, dare I bring it back up, but you know, that was part of the problem with the net neutrality debate.
My favorite subject. Yeah,
exactly. The same advocates for municipal broadband are the same people for net neutrality. Mm-hmm. And the problem with net neutrality is, I wrote a blog on this a long time ago. Net neutrality seeks to commoditize the network. You can't compete on service. You got to compete on price. And if you price, the equilibrium is going to go down. So it's a bit hypocritical for all these people going, we need municipal broadband to increase equilibrium, when you're advocating for policies that will actually shrink the, you know, you're leading to the same art. You're creating the system situation that you claim you don't want. And that's what's so cynical about the whole thing.
I think what's funny about some of these municipal broadband systems is now they build these models, financial models of the systems. There's a string of blood, you know, behind cities that have done it in the past. So at least now they try to look at it in a financial way. And I think that the studies have gotten better. The old ones used to always say it was worth doing, but now you find that it's not. But all these studies show typically you're going to need, you know, 40% market share, maybe even 70% market share to make the network profitable. Well, if you need half the market to make it profitable, how many firms can you have?
Yeah.
You know, you can have two at most. If you need 70%, then you have one at most. And
we have more cell phones than we have people. So maybe there's 120% of the market available. Yeah,
maybe. you know, former chairman Tom Wheeler was always, you know, he was promoting municipal broadband and talking about competition, when really what the municipal broadband financial models were showing you was that you could have, you know, two providers tops, you know. And so this idea that this was competitive in any way was kind of silly, because you already had.
I mean, whatever benefits it may have long term in terms of service quality, I mean, if the numbers show only two competitors for wireline service makes sense, that's all you're ever going to get.
Yeah, and that's all
you're ever going to get. What happens to the economic analysis on competition when you include, say, people that are providing broadband service over fixed 5G?
Oh, that could change. That could change things if it works. I mean, the question is whether or not that's going to be deployed in a consumer, home consumer type environment, or whether it's mainly for businesses and things like that.
Yeah, and we really don't know the answer to that now. I mean, really, the only one of the service providers that seems to be at all enthusiastic about exploring that opportunity is Verizon. I mean, because they are trialing, you know, fixed location 5G services in Sacramento and some other cities. And I don't think AT&T and T-Mobile and see it as quite a great opportunity. And we don't know what Dish is going to do with their 5G network, you know, assuming they actually build one. But could be more of a business thing, like, because they're kind of like a Legato type, kind of a boutique offering that provides a limited service, but one that, you know, for which there's enough demand to justify some investment.
Well, I don't know what Legato has a business plan, but I think, you know,
full
it could
employment
be,
for lawyers.
Yeah, well, yeah, they're gonna make some people rich flipping some spectrum. But it could end up being like when VoIP became available.
Mm-hmm.
Back, you know, I was working for a telephone company at the time, you know, reselling phone service. And, you know, I get this package in the mail. I was living in Tampa at the time, and Bright House was one of the earlier deployers.
Oh, yeah.
And and they were offering this service, which was, you know, half what I was paying, and worked just as good. And next thing you knew, you had a monopoly phone network that was now a very competitive situation. Yeah. Yeah. And 5G may come along and do that. And even if it takes 20% of the business, that's a huge margin. That's a big, big impact. I mean, mm-hmm. people don't realize that you know, just the 80-20 here rule, and maybe even smaller with respect to profits. If you skim off, mm-hmm. you know, 10% of the customers, you're pretty much sucking all the profits out of the very high fixed cost business, and it makes it very difficult to operate. So if that works, I mean, it's going to be very tricky to maintain.
Well, I mean, at the same time, that cable company like Comcast offers a 5G. They have 5G as part of their mobile phone add-on bundle. And so they're kind of everybody's playing in everybody else's backyard nowadays. I mean, these companies are no longer just sort of one service. I mean, they have content, they have, you know, fixed line broadband, they have mobile. I mean, it's the reality of the markets is a bit more free for all and chaotic than it used to be, and maybe more than most people actually realize.
But what I learned in working for the telephone companies was you look at these guys and you sometimes see them moaning and groaning about the loss of 5% market share.
Mm-hmm.
But if it's the right 5% market share, you're broke. You know, I mean, these guys kind of live on the edge. I mean, it can be nice. You got a lot of capital.
Oh yeah, it's true.
Got to earn a big return. But man, if something comes along and starts stealing your good customers, you can be in some serious trouble really, really quick.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, I mean, that's something to think about. I'd like to keep you guys on, you know, for the rest of the day, but I'm sure you got things to do. And I am looking forward to the release of that 90-page law review article that you guys talked about. And that's, I think maybe it might be a good follow-up. Yeah. So I think we'll, unless you've got some, you know, do you have some last words to say before we wrap it up?
I think it's good.
Okay, so everything that needed to be said has said it, and everyone who needed to say it has said it. There you have it, folks. This has been episode 55 of the High Tech Forum podcast with George Ford and Larry Spiewak talking about, well, basically it became a much broader conversation than just this one little report and the question of the economics and the law behind municipal broadband markets. So great topic. I'm glad they were able to join us. And folks, if you enjoyed the podcast, you know, you're welcome to leave us a review on iTunes or wherever you got it. We always publish we're publishing these days the podcast in both video and audio only format. So it's available on YouTube, Facebook, as well as iTunes and the hightechforum.org website. Check back in with us in another week or two. We've got some additional podcast that we've actually already recorded and are awaiting some editing, and we'll just sort of keep the band going. So folks, there you have it.
Thanks, Richard.
Thanks, Richard. Appreciate it.
And thanks for taking part. Richard Bennett signing off.